I'm going to introduce our keynote speaker this evening. And as I mentioned, I've been told that this guy needs to come and be our keynote. And so Dr. Talamay is here with us tonight. He's currently a professor and chair of the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware in Newark, Delaware, where he has taught insect taxonomy, behavior ecology, and other subjects. Chief among his research goals is to better understand the many ways insects interact with plants and how such interactions determine the diversity of the animal communities. Dr. Talamay has won the silver medal from the Garden Writers Association for his book, Bringing Nature Home. That's, I think, what we're going to hear about, is how do we bring nature home. Dr. Talamay?
Pleasure to be here. Don't stop eating, because it's all good food. We got a lot to talk about tonight. I was told to talk about biological carters, about talk I call networks for life. But in particular, your role in being able to create those all-important networks. But before we get into that, let's talk about box turtles. This is the eastern box turtle. Used to be very common in the east. I think I had 20 of them in a cage when I was growing up in my backyard. And we don't see them very much anymore, but when we do see them, it's typically in a field. People think they're denizens of old fields. But in fact, box turtles spend most of their time in woods, in woodlots, and most of the time they're in the woodlots, they spend buried in vegetation. But in the springtime, they go a-courting, and if they are successful, the female will leave the woodlot in order to lay her eggs. She's going to dig a hole out in a sunny patch and let the sun incubate those eggs. So now she is outside of the woodlot, and that means, of course, that the eggs hatch outside of the woodlot. Now, at this point, we don't know a whole lot about box turtle life cycles, life histories, because those eggs are hatching underground, and we don't see the little guys. They stay underground, or at least deep in leaf litter, for up to a year. And the only time you run into them is if you accidentally dig them up, like we did this one in my yard. About a year later, they're two or three times that size, but still not very big. And then the time you actually run into them again frequently is when they're back in that woodlot as adults. Now, they have a life history very similar to ours. They don't mature sexually for 15, 20 years. And they'll easily live to be 80 years old, so just kind of like Uncle Joe here. Okay, what you're looking at is what we call the University Woodlot. This is a research plot of an urban forest that has been isolated as an urban forest for at least 100 years. We're not sure what happened before that. It's a 35-acre woodlot, and if you look down from above, you see that it is completely isolated. It used to have agriculture on all sides, but now it's got athletic fields on one side and agriculture on two sides, and then a four-lane highway to the south. Now, it's not the only urban woodlot in the area. So we have one there. I guess you can't see my pointer, but one up in the corner and one down here. And there are actually box turtles in each one of those woods. But it's very difficult for those box turtles to move back and forth. What I forgot to tell you is that back in 1968, a man by the name of Paul Katz decided he was going to study box turtles in this woodlot. So the first thing he wanted to do was catch them all and mark them so he could recognize them later on. And he found 91 turtles in that woodlot in 1968. The problem with isolation, of course, is that it's a very dangerous place outside of that woodlot. When those females leave the woodlot to lay their eggs, there's a danger that they are mowed or they are plowed. The real danger comes from automobiles. I do have a picture of a squash box turtle. You want to see it? Okay, we'll skip that. But you see them on the road. I mean, it is a dangerous place outside those woodlots for box turtles. And that's why in 1968, there were 91 box turtles in the woodlot. In 2002, there were 22. And in 2010, there were 12. And what's happening here is that the population of box turtles in this woodlot is realizing its extinction debt. Recruitment is much lower than mortality, so the box turtle population gets smaller and smaller, and undoubtedly it will disappear from the woodlot altogether. And unfortunately, that's what's happening to populations that are isolated all over the world. It's not just box turtles that are in trouble. Our amphibians have the same problems. Our reptiles have the same problems. And believe it or not, even many of our insects do. This is one of the species of large flightless carabid beetles. Used to be common in the woodlot. Back in 1975, there was a survey. These beetles were all over the place. As of 2000, they had disappeared. Now, you would think that a 35-acre woodlot is big enough for a population of beetles. But remember here, these are flightless beetles. They're not moving back and forth between other woodlots, so their population just dwindled and disappeared. And that is the problem I want to talk about tonight. Biodiversity cannot be sustained in habitat fragments. And that's because habitat fragments are too small and too isolated. When you take a large space like this, a large habitat like this, and you shrink it down to a little fragment of its former self, and it doesn't have to be a tiny fragment. You're taking large populations and shrinking them down to small populations. And that's the main problem, because small populations are highly vulnerable to local extinction. And that's because populations fluctuate. In good times, they go up. In bad times, they go down. If you're a large population like that top line there, even in your down cycle, there's enough individuals so that when times get better, you can increase rapidly. But if you're a tiny population like the bottom line there, these random fluctuations often dip you down to zero. You blink out of your little habitat patch. And if it's truly an isolated habitat patch, it's very difficult to recolonize it. So it's a local extinction event. That's what's going to happen to the box turtles in the University woodlot. It's what's happening to populations all over the world. And people have been studying this for some time now. Some of these studies are over 100 years in length. The fragments of nature that we have left out there are not large enough to sustain the amount of nature we as humans need them to sustain. And that, unfortunately, includes our largest national parks. Conserving habitat fragments is not the same thing as conserving functional ecosystems. And if you look at where we are in the U.S., you'll see that what is left as untrammeled habitat is certainly little patches of its former self. We are everywhere. It's either us, it's our developments, our cities, our agriculture, but very, very little happy nature out there. So let's talk about what fragmentation has done to the species that live in those habitats, to biodiversity in general. Well, for the most part, we're not measuring it. For almost all the taxa out there, we are not measuring what's happening because of fragmentation. One thing we do know is what's happening to our birds, because we have a lot of people that like birds. We have something called the State of the Birds Report that comes out every year. In 2014, the State of the Birds Report said that there were 230 species of North American birds at risk of extinction. Just 2 years later, that's now 436 species of North American birds at risk of extinction. That's almost half of our North American birds. So the State of the Birds Report is pretty miserable. Our birds are not happy. We've got 1.5 billion fewer breeding birds in the U.S. today than we had just 40 years ago. And let me remind you that a billion is 1,000 million. We're losing our birds, we're losing much of our wildlife out there because the ecosystems that support them are not happy. And the message I keep trying to get to different people I talk to is that that's important to we humans because those are the same ecosystems that support us. If they're not happy, we better know about it. So our insects are also in trouble. We're just starting to measure this now. And actually, it was pollinators that got us interested in it. The dramatic declines in the honeybee in recent years got people thinking about that. And then, of course, followed by rapid declines in monarch butterflies. So we started looking around what is happening to our pollinators. A lot of the work has been done in the Midwest. About 50% of Midwest native bee species have disappeared from their historic ranges during the last century because those habitats are gone at this point. The four species of bumblebees that have declined 96% just in the last 20 years, you know, 96% means they're just about gone. 25% of our bumblebee species are at risk of extinction, and three species are already extinct. Now, that's bumblebees. Bumblebees, by and large, are generalist pollinators. They can go a lot of different flowers. If that's what's happening to our bumblebees, what's happening to our specialist bees? And very few people are measuring that. Doing a better job of measuring what's happening to insects in Europe, particularly in Germany. German insects have declined 5.3-fold just since 1989. There are already 46 species of moths and butterflies that have disappeared entirely from Germany. An invertebrate abundance, mostly insects, around the world has declined 45% since 1974. Why is that a problem? Well, E.O. Wilson has told us why that is a problem. He started telling us why that was a problem decades ago. This is a paper he wrote, I think it was the first paper in conservation biology, called The Little Things That Run the World. And he pointed out in that paper that if we lost insects, we'd lose our flowering plants, we'd change the structure of the terrestrial world, our food webs would collapse, mammals and amphibians and reptiles and birds and humans would disappear, and the earth would rot if we lost our insects, and we've already lost 45% of them. So the point is that a world without insects is a world without biological diversity, and I can't stress it enough, a world without biological diversity is a world without humans. So this is an important message for everybody, whether you like insects, whether you like pollinators, whether you like other living things, you absolutely need them, because that's what's keeping us around. How many do we need? How many species do we need? This is a good question. We typically, as humans, think we are the only species that we need on this planet, and that's the way we treat the rest of the species. But let's count them. How many do we actually need? I'm going to argue that we need all of them. We need all of the species that are out there, because it is those species, it is the plants and the animals that are running the ecosystems that create what we call ecosystem services that support us. We shouldn't call them ecosystem services. We should call them biodiversity services. That's what's keeping us alive. When you have a diverse ecosystem, it is more stable. So when it's perturbed by the hurricanes that we've recently witnessed, it returns to its former state much more quickly when it's diverse. It has it performs biogeochemical processes much better, like things like sequestering carbon. It's more productive. In other words, it makes more of those ecosystem services that we all need. The diverse ecosystem is also less susceptible to invasions by alien organisms. So those are all good things. But we're losing our biodiversity and the ability of the Earth to support us. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment was conducted by, I think, 165 scientists, something like that, from 2000 to 2005. These are scientists all over the world measuring the ability of the Earth to support us. And their unhappy conclusion, which they published in 2005, was that we had already degraded the Earth's ability to support us by 60%. And believe me, things haven't gotten any better since 2005. That's the same as taking planet Earth and shrinking it by 60%. And of course, we're doing this at the same time we keep increasing our populations and extracting more and more from planet Earth. So anybody, almost anybody, can see that that is not a sustainable relationship. We've got to turn that around. We've got to grow planet Earth again, increase its ability to support us. And we can do this. There is actually some good news here. We can do it. What we have to do is rebuild the Earth's carrying capacity, its ability to support life. So what's carrying capacity? That's simply the number of individuals of a particular species that can be supported sustainably, which means essentially forever in ecological time, without degrading the resource base. Those are the key words there. So if we're talking about animals, carrying capacity is created by plants. It's plants that support animals. Let's think of our bank accounts, our savings accounts, as an analogy here. So remember when we used to have savings accounts? They would generate interest. So the money in our savings account would be the principal in that account, and it would generate interest, and we could live off that interest forever as long as we didn't reduce the amount of principal in our savings account. Well, the energy that is fixed by plants is the ecological interest created in a particular ecological bank account. And the plants that are in that ecosystem are, that's the principle. They're generating that interest over and over again. So if we graph this, the dotted line there would be the amount of plants you have in a space, and this line would be the populations of animals that can grow and cycle beneath the carrying capacity as long and use, they're living off the interest that's generated by those plants. And it works forever as long as you don't reduce the amount of plant life, the principal in the ecological bank account, generating that interest. If you do reduce the amount of plants, you will have less ecological interest, and any populations depending on it will fall below the new carrying capacity. And of course, if you get rid of all the plants, you've gotten rid of all of the life, all the ecological interest. You might say, well, where have we gotten rid of all the plants? Well, think locally. We got rid of all the plants right here. This building used to be plants. Every place we pave a road or build a building. Oh, we don't want to get too depressing. Let's get back to fragmentation. So fragmentation reduces ecological principle by taking away the habitats as big plant communities that are producing the energy that support life. So the solution that has been proposed is to build biological corridors to connect those isolated habitat fragments with each other. And of course, if you connect those habitat fragments, they're no longer isolated, which means the populations within them, because they're connected with each other, are no longer tiny. So when they fluctuate naturally, they will no longer disappear. This has been proposed as the solution to our extinction woes, our local extinction woes. Build these biological carters, connect habitats all over the place, and all will be well. Okay, let's talk about that a little bit. There are actually some convenient opportunities to build biological carters. We have existing infrastructure, I guess you could say, let's just talk about North America, that lends itself to the creation of biological carter. We've got mountain ridges, we've got riparian carters, power lines, roads, rangelands. All of these things could be productive biological carters. I live in Pennsylvania, southeast Pennsylvania, and if you get in Google Earth and fly over Pennsylvania, that's what it looks like. Those are the Appalachian Mountains, and they're long, stringy things. The areas in between those mountains, of course, are the valleys. They are completely occupied. There's no habitat there. But these mountains create miles and miles of very functional carters. Although they were completely deforested around the turn of the century, those forests have grown back. They're now protected. They're not good places to farm, and they're not good places to build. So we've got good connectivity because of the existence of those mountain ridges. Now, I know you don't have a whole lot of mountain ridges here in Iowa, so let's talk about riparian carters as another opportunity. This little green stretch here is a large stream going into the Susquehanna River, again in Pennsylvania. And the green on both sides of that stream represent a biological carter. That's a riparian carter that does provide connectivity all the way from the river way up to who knows where. Now, it's not a very wide biological carter. I'd like to make it a lot wider. But it does exist, and it suggests how useful our aquatic systems, our rivers and streams throughout the U.S. could be in terms of making biological carters. If we had good riparian carters along all of our waterways, and I'm talking about right down to first-order streams, we'd be done. Everything would be connected. There's very few places in the country that don't have a network of streams already built into it. And in some places, those carters exist. But, you know, our rivers and streams used to be our roads. So that's where we developed. We haven't treated it. I mean, just look at the Mississippi right across the street here. It's certainly not developed as a biological carter. This is the Christiana Creek in Wilmington, Delaware. And that has not been created as a biological carter either. These places were good places to live until they flooded. They were good places to farm because they flooded. They were never good places to put a dump, which is what you have here, a landfill right next to the river. So we haven't capitalized on the ability of these places to serve as carters. And even our smaller streams, this is a farm down the road from me. Every time it rains, I get to watch this farm wash into the Chesapeake Bay. which is why the Chesapeake Bay is nearly dead at this point. And when it's not washing away, the cows are in there trampling it down. I mean, we know this is not good stewardship of our streams, and it's certainly not functioning as a carter, but it could. It could. What about power line cuts? We have 300,000 kilometers of power line cuts in the U.S. And you might look at them and say, well, that's actually causing fragmentation. And if you're only talking about intact giant forest, then I guess that is true. But if they're managed properly, power line cuts can provide one of the rarest types of habitats we have in this country, and that's scrub habitat. It's got to be maintained as scrub. There are birds like the golden wing warbler and several other species that only breed in scrub habitat. So when you get a cut like this, with good scrub habitat maintained that way, it actually becomes a very useful breeding place for an awful lot of our biodiversity. In other words, it's a good thing. This is a power line cut not far from me. That's Biden's Aristosa there. So it shows these things can be maintained in really productive ways. So what an ideal place for pollinators, 300,000 kilometers worth of pollinator habitat. But again, all too often, we're just not thinking about habitat opportunities with these things. The power lines are often sprayed from the air or simply mowed or sprayed from the ground, but we've got to keep that vegetation out of there. How about rangeland? 770 million acres of rangeland in the U.S. That is 20.7 times bigger than Illinois. It's a lot of rangeland out there. And it could be ideal habitat. This is a experimental range in Nebraska. And those black guys there, they're not bison. They are cattle. But they're doing pretty much what bison did. This is a properly managed rangeland. All of these yellow things here are sunflowers. So my wife and I were here for a few hours. All the grassland birds that should have been breeding there were there. I mean, this was a very happy place to be. But you drive just down the road, and this is what the rest of the rangeland looked like. Completely overgrazed, no habitat at all, either for pollinators or other types of insects. So it's an opportunity. In most cases, we're not taking advantage of it. How about roads as convenient corridors? We got a lot of roads out there. Depending on which figure you go by, we either have 4 million miles of paved roads or 6.2 million miles of paved roads. I don't know how they can be so different, but we have a lot of miles of paved roads. This interesting map was published last year. Just look at the U.S. The red areas are areas where there's a road within 1 kilometer of that space. So that's where our roads are. Absolutely everywhere, at least in North America. And typically, we have lawn. We have grass on the edges and often in the median strips of our roadways. This is the Taconic Parkway in New York. Where do you think this is? This is the Taconic Parkway in New York, about 1 mile north of that previous picture. And that wooded area is the center. What do you call those? Median. The median. That's what it is. The median strip. You know, I hear, we can't have plants in the median because animals will hide there and there'll be more accidents. And everything else. This has been this way since the 30s when it was built, or maybe it was built in the 20s. I'm not sure. So what a great place to measure accident rates. I'm sure they've got figures, and I'm pretty sure that they had cut it down by now if it was actually increasing problems. I think what happened was they built this road through a patchwork of forest and farmland, and when it was farmland, they just started mowing it, and when it was forest, they left it, which shows it is possible to have habitat in median strips and on the edges of roads. And a lot of people, particularly the pollinator people all over the country, are talking about turning our roadsides, converting them from mowed habitat into preserves for rare plants. This is Florida, where there are a number of endangered plants, and the only place you find them are on roadways that are mowed sparingly. And of course, if they're blooming plants, they could be good for pollinators. There are issues. Nobody wants to talk about these. But we have to be sure that we do not create habitat in areas or in ways that also create ecological traps for our wildlife, particularly our pollinators. We have cars going up and down, and they do kill insects. I had an undergrad walk the roads and pick up dead insects. They kill thousands of insects all the time. So the real question is not do these roadside habitats kill insects and pollinators. The question is, do they create more pollinators than they're killing? Because if they do, if the habitat is a net plus, then it's certainly worth looking at. And I'm sure this is going to be a function of car traffic and car speed and the amount of natural areas around the road and so many factors that really haven't been studied yet. But it's something we need to think about. There are many opportunities for creating habitat biological corridors associated with roads that do not involve high-speed traffic. This is a lawn in a rest stop along the Pennsylvania Turnpike. I don't know how many acres it is, and I guess it's there so we can walk our dogs, although you could actually put a tree there and walk your dog under the tree. You know, we've studied biodiversity in lawns. That's what we're doing here. We're counting it. And I still have not told her that I show this slide. There's not a lot. There's not a lot there compared to what could be there. So, you know, too often lawn just becomes the default landscape because it's relatively easy to maintain, although it's still expensive and it puts a lot of pollution into the air. So we might want to think about these clover leaves, areas where the traffic is not going very high speed that could be suitable for creating biological corridors. Okay, those are convenient opportunities, and the reason I call them convenient is we could actually put corridors in those situations and get very little pushback from the public, from politicians. It would work pretty well. Unfortunately, even if we developed all of these convenient corridors, they don't always occur where we need them. So what are we going to do with all those areas where you don't have a mountain ridge or a power line or some other convenient corridor source? Well, this is what I've been talking about for I don't know, 12 years now or something. I want to restore landscapes as many places as we can, and that includes where we live, where we work, where we play, so that everything becomes a functional biological corridor. This is a house down the street from me, and it was developed to meet this homeowner's aesthetic needs. It was developed to celebrate lawn as a status symbol. It was not developed with the idea of creating a biological corridor or supporting any other life other than lawn and calorie pear. And those calorie pears have already fallen over, so now there's no trees in that landscape. So we really need to think about sharing where we live, where we work, and where we farm with the other life forms on this planet if we want to keep them around, and we do want to keep them around. So let's think about our standard approach to biological corridors. I'm going to argue that this is not enough. I don't even like the term corridor. It suggests we're just talking about areas that allow movement from one habitat to the next. But if that's the case, we still have tiny habitats. We haven't increased the amount of habitat that's out there. So I think biological corridors have to do more than facilitate movement. They actually themselves have to support life. So let's put some plants in this landscape, increase the width of those corridors. This is better. That's even better. So these lighter areas in here, that would be where our major cities are, where much of our farmland is. But these other areas would be areas where we are. And there's no reason why we can't put more plants, more biological principle back into the places where we spend most of our time. So the point here is simply that we can save nature. At least I'm going to argue that we can, but only if we humans learn to live with it. You know, E.O. Wilson just wrote his, I don't know if it's his last book or not, but called Half Earth. Got to save half of planet Earth. Well, half of planet Earth is already in agriculture. So the other half is where we are. And I agree, we have to save half of it. His arguments are all right. He just didn't spend a lot of time telling us how. So the only way we're going to do it is to abandon the standard forms of conservation that we've all grown up with, and that is to create areas where we have wildlife and areas where we have humans, but they're not going to mix. Now we've got to share the areas where humans are, and we're going to save everything right where we exist. So let's talk about how to do that. What do we build our corridors out of? Well, we already talked about the role of plants. It's going to start with plants, and the more plants we have, the more animal life we're going to have, because plants, of course, that first trophic level are making all the food. The other thing's capturing the energy from the sun. Plants allow us and everything else to eat sunlight, so we absolutely need them. They also provide shelter, so they're making food and shelter, which quite literally means plants are a matter of life and death. If you have them, you have the option for life. If you don't, you don't. So here we have this is the new agricultural ethic here, is to get rid of all the weeds and put in lawn, and it's all very neat, but tremendous amount of lost habitat that there's very little life there, as opposed to a situation like this where you have a lot of life. Here's back to my favorite house down the street. If we put plants back into this landscape, we really can create functional ecosystems again. And we're not going to argue about what we're restoring them to. What we're restoring is ecological function. So maybe it's the way it was 200 years ago, maybe it's the way it was 400 years ago, maybe it was never like that, but it's going to be ecologically sound and have specialized relationships that are all keeping that ecosystem together and creating productivity. That is the goal. So how do we do that? We've got to put plants in these landscapes. Will any old plant do? Well, our research has shown, and actually plant-insect interaction theory has shown since the late 60s, thousands of papers, that no, any old plant won't do. All plants are not the same. Plants are very, very specific in the life that they can support. So if you want to read about this, first of all, we made it easy. In all of these papers, we would get the same answer. And that is plants are really different from each other and how they can support life. You can go to the literature, you can read, but I know you're not going to do that. So let's just talk about what I call my 12 by 12 experiment. This is something you can do at home and demonstrate to yourself how different various plants are in their ability to support the life around us. That's what 12 feet by 12 feet looks like when you stake it out in your yard or any place else. Now you get to determine how much life is going to be in that space by determining how many plants you have there and what types of plants, what species of plants you have there. You can keep it as lawn. You can get on your hands and knees on Wednesday and count all the biodiversity in that space. Won't take you long. And then of course, on Saturday you'll mow it and kill anything that you just counted. But we could put a tree in there. Let's put a white oak in that space. Now this is a white oak I planted from an acorn. It's filling that 12 by 12 space very nicely. That tree was 14 years old when I took that picture, which actually proves two things. It proves that oaks grow. Well, if you listen to landscapers who tell their clients all the time, don't plant an oak, you won't live long enough to enjoy it. I'm enjoying it. Your oak does not have to be 300 years old before you can enjoy it. You can enjoy it right away. It also was free. You do not have to. As a matter of fact, I discourage you from planting a 3-inch caliber oak whose roots have been so pruned in order to transplant it that it's going to sit there for another decade trying to rebuild those root systems and have a 50% chance of dying. Put the acorn in the ground. You get a healthier tree, and it'll be as big as the one you spent thousands of dollars on in short order. Okay, let's walk around this tree. We're back to my 12 by 12 experiment and count the caterpillars that are on that white oak just in these lower branches. We're not going to climb ladders or step ladders or anything. We're just going to walk around and count the caterpillars. And we're going to do it on July 25th of 2014, and we're going to find 410 caterpillars from 19 different species. Then I'm going to stand back, take that picture so I can ask you, how many of those caterpillars do you see? How much caterpillar damage do you see? Because that's what we worry about. We don't see any. This is the distance at which we view our trees. You don't even know there are any caterpillars on there. But if I knocked on your door and say, there's 410 caterpillars on your oak tree, get the spray can, call the man, save the tree. You don't have to save the tree. The oak is doing what it's always been doing. It's passing on part of the energy that it harnessed from the sun. And because it's willing to pass it on to higher trophic levels, I have life in my yard. If you have a plant where the leaves are perfect, nothing's been eaten, it hasn't passed any energy on, and you don't have any life. Okay, that's a white oak. Let's go to a black cherry, same afternoon, about the same size, 12 by 12, count the caterpillars at head height. We get 239 from 14 different species. Now let's go to my neighbor's house. My neighbor moved in the same month that I did, property the same size. He had different plant choices. He really liked calorie pears, which is Bradford pear, you know, an invasive species from China. So he planted 32 of them. So the first thing we have to do is figure out which Bradford pear we're going to measure. Actually, the first thing we're going to do is make sure he's not home. Let's measure this one. Let's walk around, count all the caterpillars. And I bet you're going to think I'm going to tell you that there are no caterpillars there. Not true. I did find a caterpillar. I found one. One inchworm, one species. I then went to his burning bush, another invasive species from China. 12 by 12 section, count the caterpillars. I got four caterpillars from one species, four little leaf skeletonizers, leaf miners, that are too small to be part of a local food web. Okay, of course, in science, we replicate. We want to see whether this pattern is real, so we have to either do this over and over again or build replication into the original experiment. Let's do it again the next day, July 26th. Same species, but we'll have different plants, and we'll see what we get. We get different numbers, but we get the same pattern. We get 233 on the white oak and 53 in the black cherry, two in the burning bush and one on the calorie pear. And that is the pattern you're going to get no matter where you do this and no matter how many times you do it. Actually, that's the pattern you're going to get in North America. If we go to China, it's going to flip-flop because the plants that evolved in China will support the insects that evolved in China. Because of specialization, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Rick Dark and I gave a talk in Williamsburg, Virginia, not this spring, but the previous spring. And after the talk, we drove up, crossed the Bay Bridge, up the eastern shore of Virginia and Maryland and Delaware. The first building you get to is the Sunset Beach Inn and Grill, and the timing was such that there are all the calorie pear, the Bradford pear, in full bloom, and that's why people plant them. They've got a nice white bloom in the spring. They get pretty good fall color. They don't live very long. When you get the ice storm, down they come. They're also the cheapest tree you can buy out there. So maybe the Sunset Beach Inn and Grill was trying to save some money. I don't know. We kept driving right past the Sunset Beach Inn and Grill. And the very next property was this one. It's owned by a land conservancy. I don't know how many acres it is. But look, it is thoroughly invaded with the offspring from these ornamental trees. That's what an invasive species does. Each one of these trees is not an ornamental tree, it's a biological tumor. And it has spread into that natural area, now making one caterpillar. So nothing's gonna be able to breed, nothing that needs caterpillars in that space. This is ecological castration. And I can drive from New York City to Richmond, Virginia, during this week in the spring, it is white all the way down from calorie pear, none of which were planted. They all are spreading on their own. That's what an invasive species does. So this, of course, is the horticultural dilemma of our times. Most people would argue that the Sunset Beach Inn and Grill has the right to plant anything they want on their property. Property rights. But do they have the right to biologically pollute all the land around them? Does my neighbor's calorie pear, does he have the right to make me spend half each spring pulling out his burning bush and his calorie pear and crown vetch and all the other things that have come over? I don't think he does, but. So that's something we need to think about. Instead of selling calorie pear and hoping that it doesn't spread, why don't we sell prairie crabapple and hope that it does spread? Then we're repopulating areas with plants that ought to be there. Okay, nothing's eating the calorie pear or the burning bush. Why not? Why can't insects eat any old plant? Well, that's because plants don't want to be eaten. They want to capture the energy from the sun and use it for their own growth and reproduction, so they have loaded their leaves with nasty-tasting chemicals, secondary metabolic compounds that make those leaves either bitter or downright toxic. And if you don't believe me, when you go out tomorrow, find a leaf somewhere and eat it. See if you like it. You're not going to like it. It's a really good defense that keeps most of the insects of the world from eating most of the plants of the world. And that's why when we look outside, it's green. It's not because there's nothing out there that wants to eat those plants. It's because most of the insects that are out there cannot eat those plants. They are too well defended. But we do know that insects eat plants. So how do they do that? How do they get around those chemical defenses? Well, this is where the specialization comes in. 90% of the insects that eat plants are what we call host plant specialists. They pick one or two plant lineages that are sharing a common cocktail of chemical defenses, and over evolutionary time, they develop the adaptations required to circumvent those defenses. They develop the physiological mechanisms, the enzymes that allow them to store and excrete and metabolize, sequester those compounds. They develop the behavioral adaptations and the life history adaptations that allow them to avoid those compounds in time and space. But again, it takes a long period of exposure to those plant lineages for all those adaptations to fall into place. It does not happen overnight. Let's use the monarch butterfly as an example because you already know half the story for monarchs. Monarchs, of course, are specialists on milkweeds. And there's nothing special about monarch specialization on milkweeds. They can eat all the plants in the genus because they have the adaptations to deal with the chemicals that are in milkweeds, the cardiac glycosides. And by the way, when you're eating plants, don't eat milkweeds, because cardiac glycosides will stop your heart. That's what it does. It doesn't stop the monarch's heart, and they do have a heart, by the way, because they've got those physiological adaptations to be able to deal with cardiac glycosides. What about the sticky latex sap that gives milkweeds their name? You know, when you break a leaf, you get the white goo on your finger. Everybody wipes it off right away. But if you let it sit there for a minute, maybe a minute and a half, on exposure to air, it gels. It becomes like chewing gum. And that's the defensive property of that milky latex sap. Imagine if you are a monarch caterpillar and you crawl onto a leaf and you start to chew away and you get your mandibles covered with the sap. In short order, they will be glued shut and you won't be able to open your mouth and you'll starve to death. Really effective defense. There you go, milky sap. Well, how do monarchs get around it? This is a behavioral adaptation, and this is something you can watch right in your yard if you put milkweed in your yard. Caterpillar will first walk onto a leaf. It typically goes to the end of the leaf and starts to eat. And if any latex sap starts to come out at all, it'll stop eating immediately, turn around, walk back up the leaf about two-thirds, and it starts to chew through the midrib. And what it's doing is blocking the canals in that midrib that are shunting the latex sap down to this end of the leaf. And once it's chewed through that midrib, every part south of where it chewed, distal to where it chewed, is now latex-free. So the monarch can turn around and now eat the leaf without getting any sap on its mouth parts. Very effective behavioral adaptation against a defense that's really hard to get around. The weight of the caterpillar then often flags the leaf. So if you're a monarch hunter, you can actually drive down the road and look at a milkweed patch. You can see easily, if you've got flagged leaves there, then you know there are monarch caterpillars there now, or they were there recently. So those are the upsides of specialization. The monarch is able to eat a plant that is toxic to most other insects because it's got physiological adaptations and behavioral adaptations that allow it to get around those defenses. There's a downside to that, though, and that is now that's all the monarch can eat. This level of specialization has become a curse in today's world because we humans aren't paying attention to it. If we take away milkweeds, monarchs are not going to start eating soybeans or corn or lawn or Bradford pear. The only thing the monarch's going to do then is disappear. And that, of course, is what we've seen. What, Iowa now has 82% fewer milkweeds than it had 10 years ago, some figure like that. Now, monarchs have difficulties on both ends. There are problems in Mexico, but they've declined, you know, somewhere in the 96th percentile since about 1976. And getting rid of the breeding host plant is certainly a large part of it. We've done more than that, though. By getting rid of the weeds that grow along agricultural roadsides or in any natural area, we've gotten rid of the asters and the goldenrod, the plants that actually allow monarchs to forage as they're flying south. It's another very important part of the equation. Planting milkweeds will make more monarchs, but it doesn't allow them to migrate. The milkweeds are not flowering in the fall when the monarchs have to migrate. So we need forage all the way down. We have a marketing issue with native plants. We call them all weeds. We call them milkweed, New York ironweed, Joe Pye weed, sneeze weed. And we call our invasive ornamentals, things like ailanthus, tree of heaven, Paulownia is the princess tree, Colbrotaria's golden rain tree. What if we called monarchs, or milkweeds, monarch's delight? Then everybody would want to plant it. It wouldn't be a weed anymore. We just have to change some names here. I don't want you to think that it is just caterpillars that are specialists on plants. Remember, 90% of all the insects that eat plants are specialists. This is the elderberry beetle only eats elderberry. The dogbane beetle only eats dogbane. Sumac flea beetle only eats sumac. This is a coread bug, a leaf-footed bug that only eats ash. So if the emerald ash borer comes and kills all our ashes, we will lose this species. Dave Wagner at University of Connecticut has finished a paper looking at ash specialists. 95 species will disappear if we lose our ashes. And that is the problem, the fact that so many of our insects are specialized on particular plant lineages. You can't take those plant lineages away or you're going to lose those insects. Okay, which plants should we be sure to have in our carders? Well, we've been making lists in my lab for quite a while. This is the first list we made. This is a ranked list of the woody plant genera in the mid-Atlantic states, and they're ranked by their ability to support caterpillars, Lepidoptera, from the very best up here to the very worst down here. I'm sure you can all read that. I want you to memorize it, because it proves some very important points here. There are huge differences among our plants. So this is natives and non-natives, but there are huge differences among our natives as well. This became a very popular list. Everybody wanted to focus on this first column here and say, well, if I want to make a very vibrant biological carder, if I want to put life back in my yard, I've got to use plants that are able to support the things that are passing on most of the energy. And that does happen to be caterpillars, by the way. So if I go to Iowa, people said, where's my list? If I go to California, where's my list for California? The mid-Atlantic list doesn't work for you guys. Where's my list in Florida? Well, it took my technician, Kimberly Shropshire, 2 years to make this list, 4,000 references. So I said, well, if you support my technician, she will make you a list. Well, the National Wildlife Federation said, we need these lists. So they talked the Forest Service into coming up with a year's salary for Kimberly. And they said, we'll pay Kimberly a year, but we want a list for every state in the union. As a matter of fact, we want a list for every county in every state. Can she do that? It's very hard for me to find funding for Kimberly, so I said, of course she can do that. She couldn't do it. It took her a year and a half. She worked very hard, and she got faster at it. But it's now launched on the National Wildlife Federation website called Native Plant Finder. At that URL, if you just put in Native Plant Finder, it's in beta testing right now. This is a huge data set. We had a web guy quit over this. We've hired another web guy, and he's fixing mistakes. But if you put in your zip code, the top-ranked plants for your county will pop up. Actually, all the plants ranked are supposed to pop up, both woody and herbaceous. And if you find a mistake, because we know there are mistakes, send me an email, we'll get to working on it. But by and large, it works pretty well at this point. There was an interesting side note to this. Not only can you go find the best plants for your county, but when I got to look at these lists all over the country, a very striking pattern jumped out at me. And that is that it really was just a few plant genera in any one location making most of the food. And I started calling them foraging hubs. I've learned that most folks don't like that term. I borrowed that from people who study plants in the tropics that make fruit that the birds forage on. They call those plants the foraging hubs in the tropics. So I said, well, these plants are making insects, and the birds are foraging on those insects, so I'm going to call them foraging hubs. They didn't like that. But this encouraged me. I was on a Delta plane once, just like I was today, only this day the plane wasn't going anywhere. We were sitting on the tarmac, so I started reading the Delta magazine, and that's a picture of the Delta hubs. And I said, that's exactly what I'm talking about with foraging hubs. Let's make those foraging hubs. There you go. Now, all the lines going into this oak tree here, this could be the plant the plant taxonomy, the plants that are in a particular landscape. The lines going into this oak tree here, Each one could be a species of bird, it could be a bird, could be a lizard, something going into that oak to get food to eat, because there's a lot of food there. The other black dots in this landscape are other plant genera, other plant species, and there are lines going into them, but not very many, because those plants are not making very much food. So imagine what would happen to this food web if we took these powerhouses out. We took the foraging hubs out of this landscape. You would still have dozens of other types of plants in that landscape, but it would be a failed food web because the ones making most of the food are gone. And we have found that just 5% of the local plant genera are making 75% of the food. Let's make some comparisons here. Oaks are number one in most of the areas of the country, actually. This is the figure from the Mid-Atlantic states. They support 557 species of caterpillars. And if you don't like caterpillars, call them bird food. 557 species of bird food on oaks. Let's compare that to ginkgo. Ginkgo biloba, it's an ornamental plant from China, from Asia. Our lists say that ginkgo supports four species of caterpillars. We've tracked it down. Those are all mistaken host records. It's pretty easy to get a mistaken host record. Like somebody's got Cecropia moth as being a feeder on ginkgo. And that's because Cecropia moths crawl off the black cherry they were on. They crawl for maybe 20 minutes and they crawl up on something and spin a cocoon. There's a Cecropia cocoon on my back porch right now. It wasn't eating my back porch. And it wasn't eating the ginkgo either. If anybody sees a caterpillar eating ginkgo, take a picture of it and send it to me. And I've been saying that for years and I still have no pictures. So let's put a big zero there next to ginkgo. 557 versus zero. Which one would you plant if you're trying to rebuild the power in your biological carter? Number two on lists all around the country is prunus. So things like black cherry and pin cherry and American plum, Chickasaw plum, beech plum. Very powerful. 456 species of caterpillars on prunus. Let's compare that to Zelkova. You guys use Zelkova, another street tree from China? We use it a ton back in the Mid-Atlantic. I guess because it looks like the elms that we lost to Dutch elm disease. Zero caterpillars recorded on Zelkova. So if your goal is to have a plant in your landscape that is interacting with nothing, then Zelkova is for you. But I suggest you plant a silk Zelkova or a plastic one, and it'll be just as good as your living one, and you won't even have to water it. Pieris japonica, probably the most common foundation plant in this country, at least it used to be. This illustrates an important point. We have native Pieris. It's a small genus, but we have them, but it's not very productive. Look, just two species of caterpillars recorded on native Pieris. I don't think Pieris japonica supports anything. It could have been a native viburnum that supports 103 species. So these are the decisions we make when we put plants in our landscapes. Think of the plants you put in your landscape as if they were bird feeders. There you go, they're bird feeders. Now you get to decide how well you're gonna feed the birds. You can feed them a lot, or you can feed them just a little bit. That's what the landscape down the street from me looks like. Giant lawn with almost no trees or plants in it at all. You can put food in your bird feeders. So plant things that make those caterpillars, or you can keep them empty. There's the ginkgo back there, it's a big tree, but it's not making any food. Now we can use the knowledge of host plant specialization to purposely rebuild food webs wherever we want. We're going to do it in our biological carters, but we have to understand what those food webs are comprised of. Who are the players in these food webs? And we're learning more and more about which things are actually involved in food webs. Let me give you an example. This is the white-eyed vireo, and I'm going to use this example because that's the nest that my wife Cindy found in our yard a few years ago. Now the birds knew that in order to track this food web, I had to take pictures of what they were bringing back to the nest. So they built it very low, so I could set my camera up, and I could take pictures of the caterpillars they were bringing back. Now, we know a lot about what caterpillars are eating. We know a lot about their host plants. Then we could work backwards. If we know what the species of caterpillar is, we know what plant produced it, so we know what plant we need to plant in order to support the white-eyed vireo. So let's do this for a few minutes. This is the blinded sphinx moth, a specialist on black cherry. Got a lot of black cherry at home, making blinded sphinx moths so the babies get to eat. This little guy's the chestnut chisura, and despite its common name, it's a specialist on native viburnums. Now, our house was mowed for hay before we moved in. So we know the plants that are there. They're largely the plants that we planted. And the viburnum we planted was arrowwood, viburnum dentatum, and now it is making chestnut caesuras so the babies get to eat again. This little guy is the drab prominent specialist on sycamore. We did not plant sycamore at our house, but I don't know, 13, 14 years ago, there was a big wind, blew in some sycamore seeds from someplace. One landed in my cold frame, and it germinated. And I am not very fast at weeding things out. It's now over 40 feet tall. But it's making drab prominence, so the babies get to eat again. So on and on we go. This is eight-spotted forester moth, a specialist on native grapes. We have lots of those. The lunate zaley is another specialist on black cherry. This is the spicebush swallowtail. There's its little, its phony eye and its prothorax is supposed to scare the bird into thinking it's a tree snake. It didn't work this time. It's a specialist on spicebush and its close relative, sassafras. We have both of those. This is the tufted bird dropping moth, another specialist on black cherry. So black cherry is emerging as an important component of this bird's food web. But these guys are hungry. They need a lot more than that. So let's put some black walnut in the landscape. If we do that, we get the walnut sphinx, the gray-edged boma loco, the black blotched caesura, the bride, all specialists on black walnut where I come from. If we have native maples, we get Plagiotis inchworms, the green-striped maple worm, the maple bantam dagger moth, and many others. Native elms, this is the American elm. Give us the four-horned sphinx, the double-toothed prominent. Violets, of course, will give us our fritillaries. Remember, 90% of the plant of the insects that we want to rebuild this food web with are not going to be in our yards to do that unless we have the plants that actually create those insects. So if we want the hackberry emperor, we need hackberry. If we want Cuculio asteroides, we need native asters. If we want the Arcidura flower moth and the brown hooded owlet, we need goldenrod. The hog sphinx, Pandora sphinx, Abbot sphinx all need Virginia creeper. The redbud leaf roller needs redbud. The gray furcula needs native willows. The turbulent phosphilla needs greenbrier. And the orange tufted oneida, the spiny oak caterpillar, the two-spotted oak punky, the variable oak leaf caterpillar, the red-humped oak worm, the orange-humped oak worm, the pink-striped oak worm, the delightful dagger moth, the pleasant dagger moth, the lesser oak dagger moth, the greater oak dagger moth, the epilated dagger moth, the streaked dagger moth, the afflicted dagger moth, the white-blotched heterocampa, the oblique heterocampa, the red-lined panopoder, and the laffer, and many, many more won't be there if you don't have oaks. Oaks are the most powerful plant that you could put in your landscape. And by the way, you know where I took all those pictures? I'll clap for oaks, too, because they really are special. I took all those pictures. Where did I take those pictures? My front yard. Thank you for prompting me. Everybody does say your backyard. I took them in my front yard. I really did. I hate the term backyard habitat because it implies what we're talking about here is so ugly we have to hide it in the backyard. And it's not. Oak trees are not ugly. Put them in the front yard. It'll be okay. If we eliminate front yards from our biological corridors, we've cut our opportunity in half. All right, point is, we cannot build effective corridors if we ignore our specialists. And specialization is always gonna start with the appropriate plant. Why do we want all these insects in our corridors? Because it's not just insects make caterpillars, and it's not just that they feed the birds. There are all kinds of animals that rely on insects. They really do, like EO said, turn out to be vital in terms of supporting biodiversity. All spiders eat insects, or they eat other insects, other spiders that ate insects. We've got a whole bunch of insect predators eating insect herbivores, and they themselves are vital components of local food webs. If we lost our insects, we'd lose our frogs, we'd lose our toads, we would lose all the amphibians, because they all depend on insects. So do our lizards, so do our bats, so do our rodents. You might think, well, these rodents are eating seeds. They are when they can't find enough insects. And the reason they're eating insects is that insects are really good food. Pound for pound, there's twice as much protein in insect meat as there is in beef, according to some studies. And they're also loaded with organs in their abdomen called fat bodies, high in lipids, that allow these little guys to grow quickly and reproduce quickly. And if I'm a chipmunk or if I'm a mouse, that's what I want to do. Because there's a lot of things that want to eat me. But it's the same reason that larger organisms are eating insects. They're just really good food. The skunk is digging up your yard to get the grubs that are in your yard. Possums eat a lot of insects. Raccoons eat a lot of insects. Even things we don't think of as insectivores eat a lot of insects. Like our friend the red fox here. 25% of its diet is insects. 23% of a black bear's diet is insects. Doesn't matter how big you are, you need insects. Even if you don't eat insects, you need insects. This is a sharp-shinned hawk. It's a bird predator. You might think, well, I can have sharp-shinned hawks in my neighborhood even if I get rid of all the insects. But you can't, because the birds that this guy's eating needed insects to become birds. Same thing with the garter snake. It's not eating insects directly. It's eating the frogs and toads that ate the insects. So these guys need insects indirectly. Birds, let's talk about our birds. 96% of the terrestrial birds rear their young on insects. And most of those insects are caterpillars. How many insects do we need to support viable food webs? This is an important feature here. Remember, I found a caterpillar on Bradford pear, so people will say, see, that's contributing to the local food web. Is that enough? Well, let's look at Carolina chickadee to see whether that's enough. We always think of chickadees as seed eaters, because they're at our feeder eating seed all winter long. Actually, even in the wintertime, their diet is only 50% seeds. It's still 50% insects in the wintertime. But when they're reproducing, it becomes 100% insects. Their young cannot eat seeds. As a matter of fact, they become caterpillar specialists. If they're in a rich environment, they feed them exclusively on caterpillars. And again, they're not exceptions. Most birds that are out there are rearing their young on caterpillars. So let's ask the question, why caterpillars? What is special about caterpillars? Well, it could be because they're beautiful. We have a lot of beautiful caterpillars out there, like the Pandora sphinx, the curved line owlet, the Coletta silk moth, the spiny rose caterpillar. Our black swallowtail is very beautiful. The fawn sphinx, I think that's art in the garden. The hieroglyphic moth, the spunglass caterpillar. I found one of these yesterday on my oak tree. Or it could be because they have cool names. We've got the green marvel, the once charred punky, the confused wood grain, the cynical ground cat, the neighbor, the Donald. Could be. All right. We know it's not because they have cool names. There's some very practical reasons why caterpillars are favored. First of all, most of them are soft. That means you can stuff them down the throat of your baby without fear of injuring the esophagus. So that's got to be important. They're also relatively large compared to other insects. It takes 200 aphids to equal the biomass of one medium-sized caterpillar. So do you want to hunt 200 aphids or get one caterpillar? They're very nutritious. They're high in protein, high in fats. They have a very low ratio of chitin, of exoskeleton, to the amount of food that's offered there. And that's one thing that makes them much more valuable than beetles, where there's a whole lot of exoskeleton. And it turns out they're the best source of carotenoids when birds are breeding. What's a carotenoid? That's a carotenoid. These are compounds that are only made by plants. We vertebrates don't make carotenoids. But it turns out they are essential in our diets. That's why my wife, Cindy, tells me I have to eat my carrots to get my beta carotene, I have to eat my tomatoes to get my lycopene, I have to eat my whatever that is to get my lutein. And she makes sure I eat all that stuff because they stimulate my immune system. I am generally healthier when I have access to carotenoids. They're antioxidants. They run around our body. They protect our DNA from oxidative damage. They improve our color vision. When your mother said, eat your carrots, you will see better, it turns out she was right. She didn't know she was right, but she was right. They improve sperm vitality. Who doesn't need that? Improve sexual attractiveness. Now we're talking about this prothonotary warbler male who's yellow because he's had access to lots of lutein. He's taking the pigments and putting them in his feathers. And of course, the brighter he is, the more ladies he attracts. So that's why birds need carotenoids. Chickadees, too, they're not eating carotenoids when they're reproducing, and they're also not eating plants, so they have to eat something that does eat plants. And yes, that something is insects, but there's the key. That first bar there is caterpillars. They have twice as many carotenoids as other types of insects and three times as many carotenoids as spiders, and spiders are important components of bird food webs. So it seems it's turning out that caterpillars may be essential for bird diets, particularly when they're breeding. not just optional parts of diets, but essential. And that means you're not going to be able to have enough chickadees or any other bird in your neighborhood if you don't have enough caterpillars. So that's the next question. How many caterpillars does it take to make a clutch of chickadees? It takes a whole bunch, 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars, just to the point where they leave the nest, 16 days after the eggs hatch. And then the parents feed them caterpillars another 30 days, but nobody's counted that. So we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of caterpillars to make a bird that is a third of an ounce. That's 4 pennies. What if I wanted to have a red-bellied woodpecker in my yard? They're 8 times heavier. 8 times heavier than a chickadee. How many caterpillars does that take? And of course, we don't want just chickadees and red-bellied woodpeckers in our carters. We want scarlet tanagers and titmice and blue jays and yellow throats and bluebirds and tree swallows. And there's the common yellow throat. Is he there twice? Indigo bunnings, towhees, yellow warblers, thrushes, wrens, cardinals, hummingbirds. These are all birds we expect to be in our neighborhoods. Can you imagine the number of caterpillars involved here? By the way, you might be saying, well, you don't need any insects to feed the hummingbird because it eats sugar water. And of course it does. But 80 to 90% of a hummingbird's diet is insects and spiders. And then it goes and gets the sugar water. And remember, spiders needed insects to become spiders. You're talking about a lot of insects, a lot of caterpillars required to keep breeding bird populations in your yard. Is this the type of landscape that's going to make that much food? No, it's not. And either is this. These landscapes, I mean, this was developed for aesthetics. This person must have liked Gone with the Wind. But you know what? The life in this area is now gone with the wind. There were thousands of species in that space before we developed this giant lawn. We've got to raise the bar about what we've asked our landscapes to do. In the past, we've asked them to be beautiful. We're good at that. But now they also have to support life for the reasons we've just talked about. They've got to sequester carbon because they've got way too much carbon in the atmosphere. They have to manage our watersheds. Everybody lives in a watershed. Nobody has the right to destroy it with their giant lawns. It's plants that manage that watershed. We have to put the carbon back in the soil. What's doing that? Plants, they're pumping it back in the soil. And of course, we have to support our pollinators. And the other speakers, Heather's gonna tell you why I have to support our pollinators. By the way, why do we need pollinators? Somebody's gonna tell me we need pollinators because they pollinate our crops. And they do, about a third of our crops. But I'm gonna argue that has nothing to do with it. We need pollinators because they pollinate 80% of all plants and 90% of all flowering plants. If we lost our pollinators, we would lose 80 to 90% of the plants on the planet. Not an option. It is simply not an option. And if we're not maintaining these pollinators in wild areas, we've got to maintain them in unwild areas. We're not talking about good land stewardship here. We're talking about essential land stewardship. We absolutely have to do this. That's my neighbor's house with his 32-calorie pears. He's got 10 acres, and every plant he's put on that 10 acres is a non-native plant. Why? Because when he goes to the nursery, he does what everybody else does. He's looking for something that's pretty. So, you know, if it's pretty, that works. Maybe it could be a screen, an anchor, or a focal point, but it's all about aesthetics. He's not thinking about the ecological roles that those plants need to start playing on his property. But we could be thinking that. We could find pretty plants that are protecting our food webs, our watersheds, sequestering carbon, restoring our soil, helping pollinators, doing all of those things. How do we do that? What's a biodiversity-friendly suburb look like? Well, again, we've got to get back to carters. If we create those carters connecting those natural areas, then we don't have isolated habitat fragments anymore. It's the single most important thing that's going to stop the steady drain of species from our local neighborhoods. And I suggest we put those carters in the area that's now in lawn. We've got 45.6 million acres of lawn. That's the size of New England in lawn now. Those are deadscapes. And we've done that because lawn is a status symbol. But I'm going to argue that we can change our status symbols. I went to Montana a few years ago. And I looked around, they did not have big lawns. And I asked my host, where are your big lawns? And he said, well, we only get 9 inches of rain a year. He said, but that's not our status symbol here. And I said, no, what is your status symbol? And he thought about it, and he said, big belt buckles. So I think that is the answer. If we double the size of our belt buckles and cut the size of our lawn in half, we've got it. And of course, we're gonna build those carters out of those powerhouse plants I was talking about. This is what we've done in the past. We build our house, put in a few trees, then we're exhausted. No more landscaping, so everything by default becomes lawn. Let's turn that on its head. Let's build the house and now figure out where we do want lawn. We're not going to get rid of turf grass because it's the perfect plant to walk on without killing it. So figure out where you're going to walk on your landscape, and that's where the lawn goes. I look at where my neighbors walk on their 10 acres, and it is mostly lawn. Nowhere. They're never outside. But what if you want to get married in the front yard? Then you want to have some lawn there. If you want to walk to the backyard, you need a path, throw the frisbee, have a barbecue. Wherever you're going to use your yard, that's where the lawn goes. Then everything else by default becomes heavily planted. And this becomes the landscape design challenge of our times. How do we get all these plants into our landscapes without them looking wild and messy? We can do it. And if we convince our neighbors to do it too, now you've got the connectivity with the woodlot over here and the woodlot over here, or the prairie over here and the prairie over there. You've got connectivity. We still have our lawns, so we still get to play with our lawnmowers. It'll be okay. And if we cut our lawn in half, if we replant half the area that's in lawn, let's say we've got 40 million acres, cut it in half, 20 million acres, we can build a new national park that'll be 20 million acres in size. And we're going to do it at home, so we'll call it Homegrown National Park. And it'll be bigger than the Adirondacks, plus Yellowstone, plus Yosemite, plus Grand Tetons, Canyonlands, Mount Rainier, North Cascades, Badland National Park, Olympic National Park, Sequoia National Park, the Grand Canyon, plus Denali, which is huge, plus the Great Smoky Mountains. You add up all those parks, still less than 20 million acres. So let's do that. This is the entrance to the Toledo Zoo here, with a very nice grass path filled with dandelions. Let's turn it into this. And you know, when the zoo people did this, the board of directors went nuts. They said, nobody's gonna come to the zoo anymore. Because you got rid of that lawn status symbol, yeah. Let's turn areas like this, you know, biological dead zones, put some plants in there. And people say, you can't put big trees in small lots unless you go down south, where everybody has these giant live oak trees, and they span 2 or 3 yards, and the reason nobody complains is they all love them. Then it's okay. We could do it up here, too. Let's take some of these square things here, turn them into a landscape like this. There's an island off the coast of Connecticut called Fisher's Island. It's where the rich folks go. It's where the Roosevelts live and other people. This is one of the houses there. I should have included more of the house. It's a high-end house. But this landscape is doing everything I talked about. Very appropriate, particularly for the eastern deciduous forest at the east, except supporting the pollinators, so let's put in a pollinator garden as well. This is a mulch sculpture that proves you cannot use native plants formally, except nobody told the folks in Indianapolis this is an all-native plant garden in a park in a formal setting. Formality is a function of the design. It's not a function of the plants in that design. Our native plants are used in formal gardens in Europe every single day, and it's okay because they're non-native plants over there. This is a corporate landscape, invites the people to come out at, the employees to come out at noon to get sunburn. Could be a lovely setting like this. You know, 15 minutes, you've all heard this, I'm sure. 15 minutes in a setting like this lowers your blood pressure, lowers your stress hormone, your cortisol. It boosts your immune system so you don't get cancer anymore. It improves your attitude so you don't get divorced anymore. All kinds of wonderful things happen. Just 15 minutes in a setting like that. But how do you do that? You got to do it every day. You can't go to Yellowstone in July and expect that to last the rest of the year. You have to be exposed to this every day, and the only way to do that is either live in a situation like that or work in a situation like that. So I'm going to add another ball up there, call it mental health, or call it physical health. If you put plants, trees outside of a hospital room, the patient gets better faster. If you put trees outside of a classroom, test scores go up. Why? The connection seems to be stress. When you lower stress, and exposure to these plants does, we do everything better. Everything. How do you know when you've succeeded? Countless ways to know when you've succeeded, but this is a must here. When you have holes in your leaves. This is a shingle oak. It's been eaten by a caterpillar. That caterpillar is now in the belly of a bird. This is holistic gardening. If that shingle oak had refused to pass on part of its energy, I'd have no caterpillar and I'd have no bird that ate it. So if your plants are perfect in your yard, all is not well. They're not passing on the energy. The best way to tell whether you're succeeding, of course, is if you have breeding birds in your yard, not visiting your bird feeder, but breeding in your yard, because then they're getting everything they need within 50 meters of the nest. That's a sign of success. And they won't be breeding there if you don't have enough food. So again, we can save nature, but only if we learn to live with it. And I'm going to leave you with one simple story about how easy this can actually be. This is the Atala butterfly in South Florida, and it turns out that residential neighborhoods in South Florida accidentally saved this butterfly from extinction. How'd they do that? It's a beautiful lycaenid butterfly, beautiful as an adult, beautiful as a caterpillar, beautiful as a chrysalis, but it's an extreme host plant specialist, only eats one species of plant, the kunti, a native cycad in South Florida. Well, kunti had an interesting history, had a lot of starch in its roots. The Seminole Native Americans used to use it as a source of starch, and when the settlers came to South Florida, they taught them, there's a lot of starch in kunti roots, use it. So the settlers did. But around 1900, somebody said, let's make a starch industry out of kunti roots. So in 1900, the starch in our shirt collars came from kunti roots, and it was very successful. In the 1908 or whatever it was, census in Miami, 80% of the people identified their occupation as starch gatherers. And they did. They gathered all the starch. They eliminated kunti from the wild. It is extirpated from the wild. There were a few plants in gardens, but it disappeared. So, of course, if you take away the only host plant for the butterfly disappears as well. Well, in 1974, I guess it was, we got the Endangered Species Act. There was a desperate attempt to find some Atalas in Florida so they could get it listed as an endangered species, so they could get some federal funding to try to save it. And they looked all over the place. They couldn't find any. So instead, they got it listed as officially extinct. But about that time, somebody in the horticultural trade recognized kunti as a valuable landscape plant. It's a low-growing evergreen shrub that does well in the sandy soils of South Florida, so they started to promote it. Now you have these big plantings of kunti in parks and in people's homes and residential neighborhoods. And look who showed up again. I used to say nobody knows where it came from, but apparently somebody's found a remnant population on one of the keys. Maybe it's not there anymore, but it was there last week. And it's out colonizing the kunti plantings in residential neighborhoods. It still looks extirpated from the wild, but it's all planned landscapes now. And that's what I love about this story. This truly was an accident. They never got the Atala listed as an endangered species. They never got one dime of conservation funds, which is good because we don't have very many dimes of conservation money. The only thing it did was add one plant to the palette of plants that is commonly used in residential landscaping, and the butterfly saved itself, which shows this is a really powerful form of conservation. If we can save this butterfly by accident, by changing the way we landscape, think what we could do if we made conservation a conscious goal of landscaping. I think it's going to work, because nature has proved to be a lot more malleable and resilient and forgiving than I ever thought she would be. Not endlessly forgiving, though, I can assure you of that, but I do think she's going to give us one more chance. And remember what the Donald says, make America native again. Thank you very much.